Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're staying in our national parks for the rest of the show, although the story we're about to follow takes us on a long journey across many states and even beyond our borders. But it all begins in one of America's most scenic parks. We're off to study butterfly migration in the Great Smoky Mountains National Parks of Tennessee. It's a flight of fancy, which we all need on a regular basis, when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. Everyone at some time has heard the legend that monarch butterflies migrate thousands of miles each fall and spring. There's probably a good percentage of people who've tucked that factoid amongst the other suburban legends. After all, how could a butterfly actually take such a journey? You're about to find out. Fall is in the air, and it's a time for change, and a lot of creatures are having to look at what's coming up, and what that means for most creatures in North America is winter. Most animals that are on their own try to figure out how to adapt. Many go into hibernation. Some decide to get out of Dodge and head to warmer climates, and there's some legendary tales about that, particularly as we watch the fall migration of birds. But there's a wonderful story that we're all familiar with, but we're going to go a little more in-depth on that, and that is the miraculous migrations of monarch butterflies. It's an astonishing story, and to help interpret that at a much greater depth, we're now joined by Jason Love, who is the citizen scientist with the Great Smoky Mountains Institute in Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Jason, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you for having me.
First of all, talk about the Great Smoky Mountains Institute and what you do and how that actually works in partnership with national parks.
Right. We're a nonprofit organization. We partner with the park, and we mainly focus with school groups. So we're a residential environmental education center, and schools can spend from 3 to 5 days here in a national park, and they're out every day exploring the trails, exploring the streams, doing all sorts of interesting natural history investigations. We also have summer programs, and we have field ecology camp that's targeted to 13 to 17-year-olds where we work with scientists and do real research. We also have a discovery camp for younger students, ages 9 to 13, and natural expeditions camp, ages 11 to 13. So we have a whole bunch of stuff going on. We also have adult programs. And so every week, something is happening, whether it's in the school year or in the summer.
As you say, it's a residential camp, so people come and stay for days.
Correct.
Oftentimes in some sort of dormitory, I suppose.
Right.
And it's an extraordinary opportunity. In terms of your school groups, most of them, I'm sure, are coming from your local area, but let's say someone from Massachusetts decided that they would like to visit the park. Is that possible?
Yes. We've had groups come from as far away as Miami, Florida, Michigan, so all of our information is on the web, www.gsmit.org, and you can find any information, and there's a phone number there if you want to schedule a trip here.
Well, there's a really interesting program that you're working on right now, because that's the way science works. You have to do it when it's possible, and this is that you're involved in a program in association with MonarchWatch.com, which is you're tagging monarch butterflies. Why don't you give us the science behind your project?
This started a while ago. There was no one knew where the monarchs migrated. So finally, a scientist, I believe it wasn't until the 1970s, that a tagged monarch was finally found in Mexico, and they discovered that was where the eastern monarchs were migrating and spending the winter. Since then, there's been concern about the monarch migration. Although monarchs are still fairly common, there is concern that their wintering grounds are being impacted by logging, and also their summer grounds in North America are being impacted by habitat degradation. There's some concern of the ozone damage that the milkweed is susceptible to that's causing mortality to the milkweed, and then just weed eaters and herbicides for the milkweed. Some people consider it a weedy species. So because of that, this Monarch Watch program was started up, and so it allows citizens and scientists to tag monarchs to kind of see what their population dynamics are doing and kind of determine their survivorship and how many of these monarchs are actually reaching their wintering ground.
How long has the Institute been involved in this project?
The Institute has been involved approximately since 1995.
Oh, wow.
They started, we had a naturalist here that started tagging on her own, and from that it's kind of grown every year. I started in April, and the person in my position, Michelle Prisby, her master's work was on the monarch butterfly, so she expanded it from there and did studies on monarch larvae and other aspects of the monarch. So.
So you actually have some real numbers in terms of the population's increases, decreases. I know, I think it was within the last 2 years there was a serious impact in Mexico.
Right.
And the numbers went down. Were you able to be aware of that from your studies there?
We could see it. I mean, last year we only caught a few dozen species, and already this year we've caught 67 monarchs, and the season's just now peaking. So people I've talked to from previous years, this is my first time doing it, but people have said that this year is a really good year for tagging monarchs in the park.
It's amazing the fecundity of the creatures, the capacity to come back even after these impacts. It's a bit of a mystery from a scientific perspective. Well, talk too about some of the specifics of the monarch butterflies. They're sort of two different flyways and destinations. Why don't you talk about that life cycle throughout the year?
Right. Well, the monarchs are in the east. Spend their winters in the Transvolcanic Mountains of Mexico. It's about 2 miles high in elevation, so they're not really warm there, but it does offer some form of protection. Starting in, I want to say, about February, they start slowly migrating north, and as the milkweed blooms or comes up, the monarchs start laying their eggs on that milkweed. That generation will then die, and then the next generation will go a little bit further north. And so this continues until about 3 to 5 generations later. The monarchs then return to Mexico. So it's usually the third. It depends on where the monarchs get to, but it's usually the third to fifth generation of monarchs that actually returns to the Transvolcanic Mountains. Now, if you're in the western part of the country, a lot of those monarchs go to the coast of California and overwinter.
So. Well, the amazing thing about that is the fact that these little tiny creatures that are so delicate and can be tossed around in the wind end up making over a 3,000-mile migration. It actually is difficult to understand, first of all, how in the world they're able to do that, but it also raises some rather fascinating questions related to, here you take an individual, just like a bird, but in this little tiny insect brain is the knowledge, number one, that it's time to go, number two, the direction to go, depending on what season it is. They head south in the winter, and they find that spot, which again is a mystery, and then they overwinter, and then they head north in the spring again. There's a lot of information going on there. In the insect mind, and it's one of the great stories in the natural world.
Right, scientists are still puzzled how they do it. Birds, I mean, they have other flocks to follow sometimes, or have been there. This is a butterfly that is a couple generations removed from its wintering ground. So, how does it know how to get there? Scientists still are puzzled how all this information is packed and how it does it. It's a miracle of nature that scientists are still trying to figure out.
When I was in college, I actually worked on some of the original research on monarch butterfly migration. We were studying primarily what caused the butterfly to migrate. One of the things that happens is the fact that the butterfly has to go through some literal body changes. In order to make this flight, it has to have the energy to do so, because it doesn't really feed along the way very much, and so it has to put on a tremendous amount of fat, which is the energy to get it down there. As well, other things have to happen. They want to travel light, so male testes just disappear. during that time. We ultimately determined was the fact that these hormonal changes were inspired by a change, lengthening and decreasing in the daylight, and that actually creates these hormonal changes. So it's really quite astonishing. Well, I'm curious now, in terms of how you go about the tagging, what's involved?
Well, we send out a letter to our volunteers. We have a bunch of citizen scientists that regularly come to Tremont to do some of our science projects in the park. We send out a mass email to folks and let them know it's time of year again to tag monarchs. The actual tagging process involves catching a monarch, determining whether it's a male or female. The males have a little pouch on the upper hind wing, and that's how you can tell the males apart. And then we simply grab a sticker. It's no bigger, it's smaller than a dime, and place that sticker on the underside of the hind wing in a particular cell. And that sticker has a unique code, and we can then look up that code later. If recovery folks in Mexico can look that number up and can say, okay, this is number HCZ133, and they look it up and say, okay, this came from Case Cove, Great Smoky Mountain. So that's basically how the tagging works, just a simple sticker, nothing complex.
Let's say that I'm a volunteer, and I show up and I want to participate. What do you give me, a butterfly net?
We give you a butterfly net. Before we let you use it, we kind of go through the proper techniques of handling a butterfly net. We then talk about safety issues. This time of year, the yellow jackets are out. They're a little ornery this time of year, so we warn people about that. That's the only time it's a good time to run if you step in a yellow jacket net. Then we just go over the tagging. One of the naturalists in this area actually raises monarchs, and she'll bring some out to the park, and people will get a first-hand look of how to gently take that monarch out of the net and then the process of tagging. So we cover all that within the first 30 minutes of people arriving.
So then I head out, and are there locations that you direct me to, or do I just kind of head out on my own?
Right. We have specific locations that we try to go to. There's about 3 to 4 fields in Case Cove. Case Cove, for folks who aren't who haven't been to the Smoky Mountains, Case Cove is in the western part of the park, and it's a cove, a remarkably flat valley with mountains all around it. It has a limestone geology, and because of that, this area was farmed. And so the park still maintains it in meadows of various successional stages. So it's a great place to find monarchs coming in and nectaring on thistles, sometimes goldenrod. So that's where we target the monarch tag, and we have a couple old fields that we go to.
How long typically do the monarchs migrate through?
We have tagged monarchs as late as middle of November. So there are some still trickling through. Right now is the peak time for tagging monarchs, but they will trickle through all on into November.
Now, back in Mexico, when they when they pick up one of your monarchs, what's the feedback in terms of how long that journey takes?
Usually it takes a couple months for the actual monarch to arrive in Mexico, and we can then go to the Monarch Watch site and we can type in our names as the ones who tagged the monarch, and then if a recovery person in Mexico actually finds the tag, our names will show up on that list, and there's a certificate that the taggers receive if their monarch makes it all the way to Mexico. So it's kind of a neat way to connect people, particularly kids, to the monarch migration. It's just kind of the wondrous miracle of the monarch.
So fascinating.
Kids get really, really neat, particularly if they can get a certificate in the mail saying, hey, remember that monarch you tagged back in October? Well, it's January now, and it's found its way to Mexico.
Oh, that would be really, really exciting for anybody, really.
Yeah.
Because you've kind of gone on that journey with them.
Right.
Now, in Mexico, when they get a monarch like that, then do they record the information and re-release the butterfly?
They do record the information and let the butterfly go on its way. So they don't re-tag it, can see the tag, write down that number, and then release it.
So conceivably, you could actually see that butterfly passing through your area in the spring again.
Correct, yeah. There is a possibility that could happen.
Is
I'm not aware of anything. In the park, we've only had one monarch and this was in 2001, one monarch from the park was found and recovered in the Transvolcanic Mountains.
Yeah.
So that was pretty exciting, because when we started this project, folks didn't think there were monarchs here in the Case Cove, or at least not in numbers that would justify having a monarch tagging project in the park. I mean, in some areas, the monarchs are much more numerous. The Smoky Mountains are not a major flyway for the monarchs, but we do get them. So it just comes to show that, you know, you think you might know something, but once you actually start it, you find out new things. So monarchs are here. They are in decent numbers in the park, and they're making it to Mexico.
Now, this actually is a nationwide program, monarchwatch.com, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So people all over the country can participate as they want as a volunteer.
Right, and it's a great project. It's one of my favorite citizen science projects because it's relatively easy to ID a monarch compared to the other butterflies. Once you see one, your eye is focused on that. It's easy to differentiate the sexes, and then it's easy to capture them and tag them. So you don't have to be, your last initials don't have to be PhD to do something like that.
No,
anybody can do it.
I'm in California. If I wanted to participate, I would contact Monarch Watch, and do they actually provide then stickers or something like that?
Right. You do have to pay a fee for the stickers. I believe, I want to say ours, we got 200 stickers, and I believe that was around $40,
mm-hmm.
Give or take a couple bucks.
Mm-hmm. I'm always looking for another excuse to get outside, and what a great way to spend some time in the fall and in the spring, out catching butterflies with a purpose. That's a great thing to do.
Yeah, it's neat. And most people haven't caught butterflies before, so we do target all species of butterflies, and it also helps us create a list for the park that we GPS those points and the park can use as well. So we're focusing on monarchs, but if it's a slow day, there's always other butterflies and students and adults. Learn about other butterflies in the area, too.
One of the things that people don't think about as much as they possibly should when they think about national parks, and that is the institutes and the opportunity to really do real research and science, and there's any number of opportunities throughout the national park system, and obviously what's happening at the Great Smoky Mountains Institute is just an example of the great things that people can do as part of the national park system.
Right. Yeah, it's important to get involved. It's your national park, and with budget cuts, citizens are becoming more important in collecting data. So this is a great project. You think of the Christmas bird count and the breeding bird survey, other projects that citizens have gotten involved with and actually made some really good data that scientists can then publish on. So this is in that same vein, the Monarch Watch. So it is definitely a good project for folks to get involved with.
Now, in just a little bit different vein, tell me what's happening in Great Smoky Mountains right now. If you were I were to be there, what would I be experiencing?
Right now, today is a fairly warm day. It's in the 70s. The leaves are starting to turn. The sourwood trees are turning red. Some of the other trees are just now starting to yellow. Peak color won't be here until a couple weeks. Right now, we have a school group out that are going on a geology hike to the Spruce Flats Falls. There are some threats to the park right now, invasive exotic species. One of the things that we're most worried about is the loss of our eastern hemlock trees. We have the hemlock woolly adelgid, a species that was brought from Asia, and it is killing our hemlock trees. So right now, when I look out the window, I see the hemlocks, and they look healthy right now, but I know that in the next couple years, that picture could change. So things are always changing the park, some for the better, some for the worse. But right now, the hemlocks are green. That could change next year.
Well, one of the most fantastic parks, there's so many great parks, but one of the really great ones is the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. So, Jason, if people want to, again, find out about the Institute, give them that website.
The website is www.gsmit.org.
Jason Love, citizen scientist with the Great Smoky Mountains Institute. I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Hey, thank you, Sydney. Enjoyed it.
Do whatever it takes to keep your national parks yours so that the wonders will forever be ours. Next week, we're doing a vision quest to the new Earth Park that's about to take shape, bring you updates on the elusive ivory-billed woodpecker, which may or may not be hiding in Florida, and, well, you'll just have to tune in next Thursday or any day on the archives when your voice of the earth calls out around the world. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.